wanted to introduce James Robinson, who really needs no introduction. One of the university professors at the Harris School of Public Policy in the University of Chicago. James has done lots of papers and books, most importantly, Why Nations Fail, which has been translated into, I learned yesterday, into Finnish, along with 37 other languages,
yeah.
Including an illegal translation into Uzbek.
Uzbek. Okay. Uzbek. Well, no, it's not available yet. If you drop me an email, I'll let you know when the Uzbek translation is out.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to that. And there's also a new book coming on. I will give a plug for James's new book, The Balance of Power, forthcoming Penguin, September 2019.
Yeah.
You can pre-order in Amazon. When you get back, do it quick, right away, as soon as you can. Before
makes very good birthday presents, bar mitzvah, Christmas. You missed Christmas.
And as, you know, also, you know, James's papers are, of course, phenomenal. But this one paper, which we checked this morning, the AJR 2001 paper in AER, how many citations has it got? 12,000 citations, Google Scholar citations. That's pretty much, you know, that itself makes one of the most cited papers in economics. But I also wanted to actually use this opportunity to actually acknowledge my own intellectual debt to James, because a lot of us are working in institutions, separate economy, around the 2000s. We knew policies were not the answer to long-run economic development. We knew institutions were the answer, the rules of the game. But we got stuck because we didn't know what actually shaped institutions, what made institutions change, why some institutions which were pretty lousy persisted over time. And then came this paper that James wrote, along with also the paper that I really like, the 2000 paper in the Handbook Economic Growth, Institutional Source of Long-Run Economic Growth, which brought in power and politics in a way economists never really did before. It brought in power and politics in a way that actually used economics language, formal modeling, and very careful empirical testing in a way which opened the door for all that we see now. That, I mean, I have to say that was a phenomenal paper, and I am surprised still that paper is not the paper that many people actually look to for guidance in this area. But that's a great paper.
You win some, you lose some.
Exactly. But also want to say that James has been to WIDA before. He came here in 2010, and he wrote this book, The Role of Elites in Economic Development, which was published in 2012, one of my favorite WIDA books. And within 2 years, he became a paperback. He did it with Alice Amston, the late Alice Amston. And Alice said that DiCaprio was here in WIDA at that time. So, you know, James was here before. I'm really hoping that James, this is the start of a new relationship with WIDA, so this is not your first visit after a long time, but more of such a, where we can think of new projects and new work. But great to have you here. You changed the title of your presentation,
yeah.
And I think so, I've got a more interesting new title. But
you hold that thought.
All right, but thanks so much and look forward to your talk.
Okay.
What are minutes, you think? How many minutes do you want? Because you have an hour and a half.
So. Yeah, let's see, I'm pretty sick yesterday. I was sicker yesterday, and after 50 minutes, I really ran out of steam yesterday. So let's
keep on as long as you can
50,
go.
Yeah, yeah. 50 minutes might be good today. Thanks very much. That was very generous. You know, it's funny with these citations. I used to have a colleague, Theda Scotchpole, a very famous political sociologist, who was one of my colleagues at Harvard. And when anyone ever mentioned citations, she'd always say, "But you don't know if people are criticizing it and saying the work is terrible." And I'd always say, "No, but any publicity is good publicity, Theda. That's how things work in academia. You know, we criticize each other, you know." But she was convinced that you should distinguish between laudatory, you know, citations. "Oh, what a fabulous article. And we just love them." Like, no, this is all completely wrong. But I think we shouldn't discriminate like that, should we? That's how academia is. Anyway, but I always, when somebody mentions that, I always think of, I can see Theda's face. Okay, good. So, yeah, I'm not going to talk about, Kunal wanted me to talk about this talk I gave at London Business School in October, but I thought, I decided that I'd do something much more wild and try to put together some thoughts that I've been having for a long time about how to think about African development. So you might find this a little bit wild. There's no data and there's no model. But there's lots of ideas, I think, and ideas are good, aren't they? You may disagree with the ideas. You know, we may interpret the facts in a different way. But I guess this is the way I come to think about African development. Okay, so this perspective sort of starts with two principles. Okay, so I'm going to argue that, and I'm going to illustrate, there's two principles that just seem to hit me all the time working in Africa. One is this notion of wealth in people, which comes out of the kind of ethnographic literature, which I'm going to illustrate in a second. And one is what I'm going to call this radical egalitarianism of African society. Okay, I just throw up here a famous quote from the anthropologist, then philosopher Mary Douglas. You know, her dissertation, she wrote her dissertation about the Lele of Kasai, you know, which is a place where I've been working for a long time now. Those who have anything to do with the Lele must have noticed the absence of anyone who could give orders with a reasonable hope of being obeyed. So she paints this picture of a kind of radically egalitarian society which kind of rejects authority and hierarchy. And I think that's very, in my personal experience, very systematic in Africa. So Africa's a big heterogeneous thing. So I'm going to start with, I'll give examples from different parts of Africa, and you're all going to be able to think of anomalous cases or things that don't fit the, you know, so I'm happy to discuss that, and I'll talk a little bit about some obvious exceptions like Rwanda to this claim, like Rwanda and Botswana at the end, but you know, so bear with me, okay? So I'm going to try to illustrate these two principles, so-called wealth in people and radical egalitarianism, and what the consequences of that are. So what do I mean by wealth in people? Well, I always like this example, which comes from John Iniff's book, Africans, which is the difference between chess and Mancala. So chess, you know, we play chess. You know, we grow up playing chess. In chess, winning chess means obliterating the opposition. You know, it means kicking them off the board, taking the pieces and killing them. But Mancala, that's not how you win in Mancala. In Mancala, you just get the other pieces into your team. You know, you don't obliterate them. You accumulate them. Okay, so, you know, if you've read Thomas Piketty's book, when you say the word, well, you've read anything in economics, when you talk about capital, you think of produce means of production, physical stuff, material goods. But I want wealth, you know, as, you know, etc., land, houses, capital, claims on capital like stocks. But I'm going to think about wealth as personal relationships, personal ties, networks, dependence, etc. Okay, so here's an example from Asante a long time ago. Robert Rattray, who was the famous kind of first British colonial anthropologist of Asante, he wrote a book about the Asante Constitution in 1928, and here's what he says. A condition of voluntary servitude was, in a very literal sense, the heritage of every Asante. It formed, indeed, the essential basis of his social system. In West Africa, it was the masterless class of men and women who ran the imminent danger of having what we should term their freedom, turned it into involuntary bondage of a much more drastic nature, of course, by which he means slavery. Okay, so Rattray kind of paints this picture of everyone has to have a patron, everyone has to be in a relationship with somebody. Here's an Asante proverb he wrote down. If you have not a master, a beast will catch you. Okay, so the picture he paints, I think this is not the whole picture, but the picture he paints is that in this kind of Hobbesian world, you know, of early modern or 19th century West Africa, it's a bit hard to understand how historic this is, of course, you know, you had to surrender your freedom to become a client. You tied yourself to somebody more powerful because that was the way of getting protection. People could protect you. Land couldn't protect you, but people could protect you. Okay, so, and there's many, many social institutions in Africa which evolved to formalize these notions of wealth in people. Okay, obviously, marriage, polygamy was a way of accumulating people, but pawnship, you know, where you pawned yourself to a person in exchange for a debt, wardship, you know, where you sent off your people, would send off their children to other people to look after them as wards, and of course, slavery. Okay, so I want you to think about this idea of wealth in people, that your accumulation strategy is really about accumulating social ties and dependents and clients and relations, and not about accumulating stuff. So why would you do that? Well, you know, what Rattray suggests is, as I said, you know, people can protect you, but capital goods can't. So, but I also think, you know, and I'll come back to this, and for those of you who were at my talk yesterday, I was so out of it, I didn't realize any of you were there yesterday, I talked about the TIV. I'm going to talk about the TIV again because I just like talking about the TIV so much. But I'll talk about the TIV economy, which I didn't talk about yesterday. Okay, but also because other assets, like land, were not scarce, and what I'll also emphasize, not commoditized. Okay, so land today in most parts of rural Africa, outside of places with a lot of colonial settlement, is not commoditized. So you can't really accumulate land. You can't accumulate land the way you can accumulate land in the United States or in Finland. But you can accumulate people. Okay. One thing that really strikes me as being related to this notion of wealth in people is this notion of fictive kinship. So in Kananga, so Nathan Nunn and I have been working in Kananga for the last 9 years. In the local language, it's what they have what's called a classificatory kinship system. Okay? There's four words to refer to kin: father, mother, brother, sister. Okay? You don't have all this detailed, complicated way of talking about cousins and aunts and uncles and nephews. It's just father, mother, brother, sister. Okay? So you know that the more complicated thing, that's what's called a descriptive kinship system. By anthropologists, you know, this stuff is not so fashionable nowadays in anthropology. But I think as a fact, this is true. Okay, so what I think is extremely interesting about this particular type of kinship system is it's extremely flexible for establishing relationships with people. Okay, that this descriptive kinship system that we're all used to kind of specifies something that looks like some kind of genetic, you know, my niece is the daughter of my father's sister, and, you know, so it has a sort of rigidity about it. Whereas this system is extremely flexible, and it allows you to much more easily to claim connections and with people who are not your blood. And that's a DNA relatives, you know, so that's a controversial thing. But I just think this notion of fictive kinship, that part of this idea of wealth in people is that you're endlessly trying to make connections with people. So here's an example which I like very much, which I call the strange case of Andre Kasongo Ilunga. So in 2007, Prime Minister Matata in the Democratic Republic of Congo was putting a new cabinet together. He needed a Minister of Trade. What did he do? He appointed Andre Kasongo Ilunga. Who was that guy? Well, you know, he'd been proposed by this UNAFEC, which was a sort of small party in President Kabila's coalition. You know, they needed to get some stuff, okay? But there's one thing. He didn't exist. He'd been proposed by the leader of the party because he thought that, well, you know, Matata never met this guy. Of course he's going to pick me. All right? So what the heck is going on with that? But either way, I think about that, and this is just an interpretation, is I did ask Prime Minister Matata this. I actually know him, but he avoided the question. I asked him again, and then he left the room. So I didn't. I'm working on it. But my interpretation of this is you give me a list of people, and I'm like, oh, I don't know that guy. You know, we should get him, we should make him one of our people. We should get him in our team. He should be, you know, that's, so the fact that you didn't know him, that, well, let's get him in, let's make him one of our people. So I think this looks like a crazy story, and it was floating around in the media as a sort of crazy, like, oh, the Congolese are so incompetent. You know, like, how could you do that? But I think there's a logic to it. Okay, so what's the implications of this for political development? Well, if you think of a society based on this very personalized way of exercising authority, you know, building networks, clientship, dependency, very hard to scale up. Okay, it's somehow sort of intrinsically a small scale thing. It's very hard to create that at scale. Okay. It's also very hard to pass on. It's hard to pass on to your children. So it's really a situation where status is much more achieved. You know, like the classic notion of a big man, which appears more in the ethnography on New Guinea than in Africa, but you know, but it's sort of like it's achieved status. You know, some people are just good at putting coalitions together and building networks, but that's not a skill that's easy to pass on. So it's intrinsically limited in the sense of it's hard to pass on the power and it's hard to scale up. Okay. I think, you know, if you want to think about this notion of a neo-patrimonial state, which is the kind of dominant paradigm in African studies about, you know, why state capacity is so low and why it's so difficult to raise resources or provide public goods, because everything is based on these kind of patrimonial relationships. Where does that come from? It comes from the fact that it's sitting in this society with this social logic of accumulation of wealth in people. That's my idea. So I mean that's my claim. So you know, and this has some of the obvious implications for, say, public good provision. Okay, what about egalitarianism? I'm going to give you this example I gave yesterday. So some of you are going to be bored. You can check your email. But then I'm going to give you a bunch of other examples, not just the TIV. Okay. So I'm going to come back to this, but this is the first idea. There's this social logic of accumulation in Africa, which is based not on accumulating stuff. Of course, you can accumulate stuff and people like stuff, but stuff is often used for then accumulating more social ties and bringing more people into the network. So that's the first observation. Let me talk about egalitarianism. So my sense is that, you know, and you know, I'm going to come to the question of, am I talking about something historic or am I talking about something today? Okay, I'm going to come to that. But you might imagine that the only reason I'm going through all of this is that I think it actually has important implications for African development today. Otherwise, it would just be historically interesting. Okay, so here's the here's the story about the TIV. So here's the TIV land in southeastern Nigeria. The reason that, you know, Daron and I got so interested in the TIV is that it was studied by these anthropologists, Paul and Laura Bohannon, who were particularly interested in the political organization of the TIV. Why were the TIV organized the way they were? So they were a stateless society at the time of British colonization. They had chiefs, but chiefs didn't really have any authority. It was a bit like Mary Douglas's statement about the Lele. You know, they couldn't really tell anybody what to do. So, and the way Bohannon tells the story about, you know, why is that? Why weren't there chiefs? Why didn't people accumulate power? You know, as economists, we tend to think of, you know, political centralization as something that solves collective action problem, provides public goods, kind of basic things that you need to have prosperity. So why was it so difficult to do that? Okay, and the way that Bohannon tells the story is that, you know, he tells it in a very particular context, which is from the 1930s, there was a cult which spread through TIV land called Nyambua. And in the cult, a gentleman called Kokwa sold to people protection from witches. Okay, and in particular, when you gave him some money, you had to drink something. I'm not quite sure what's in that. And he gave you a fly whisk. Okay, so this is a TIV diviner from Bohannon's book of photographs. He gave you a fly whisk. What did you do with the fly whisk? Well, the fly whisk was used to look for witches. Okay, and to understand the significance of this, you have to understand this word sav. So sav, T-S-A-V. So that in the TIV language, that means power, particularly sort of charismatic power of individuals. So, you know, like Kunal, he has power. You know, he has sav. He's like a charismatic guy. He can get other people to do what he wants. He can get them energized about research projects, get them working together, get them excited about questions. And, you know, some people are just like that. Okay, but the thing about sav is that sav can also be accumulated illicitly, okay, by eating corpses. So that causes a problem. Somebody has sav, but you don't really know if they just intrinsically have sav or whether they've accumulated it via eating corpses. Okay, so the thing about the fly whisk was it was meant to search out illicit salve. And, you know, here's the thing which is really interesting. You know, Bohannon points out that this word, umbatsav, has two meanings. Whoops. What did I do with that? What did I do with that slide? Okay. I don't know. Okay, I'll tell you what meanings it has. Umbatsav is the plural of sav, meaning people with sav. Okay? But umbatsav has a different meaning. The other meaning is a group of witches organized for nefarious purposes to eat corpses to improve their power. Okay? So the way Bohannon tells this is that's sort of like the word politician having two meanings. You know, the word politician can mean people who contest power, you know, for office, etc. Or it can mean a group of witches organized for nefarious purposes. So anyone who became powerful and tried to boss people around or started exercising authority was immediately potentially accused of being a witch and having accumulated salve illicitly. Okay? So Bohannon, the way Bohannon says, it's like there's always this whittling down of the powerful. Okay? Men who acquired too much power were whittled down by means of witchcraft accusations. Nyambua was one of a regular series of movements to which tipped political action with its distrust of power. Okay, so its distrust of power gives rise to, so that the greater political institutions, one based on the lineage system and egalitarianism, can be preserved. So this was a very egalitarian society, and they had all sorts of mechanisms and social norms to preserve that egalitarianism. And I think, you know, what you see in Africa historically, we can talk about today coming up, is there's lots of ways of solving the same problem. There's lots of ways of preserving egalitarianism. Okay? So it could be the TIV use witchcraft accusations, and that's not uncommon. But there's lots of other ways of doing it. Think about East Africa. Think about these societies like the Samburu or the Maasai, organized in age grades. Okay? So there you have this system of rotating age grades. Men, sometimes women also have age grades, but mostly men, they go through this life cycle of, you know, you're a boy, you become initiated, you become a warrior, you retire, you become a farmer, you get married, then you become a politician, then you become a super, you know, practicer of supernatural, and then the next cohorts come. So political power is endlessly being rotated between these cohorts. It's very difficult to accumulate any family or lineage because it's intrinsically limited and endlessly rotating. Okay, in many of these societies, this is true also about the TIV, you have this balanced opposition between different parts of the kinship system. You know, this is like the famous Berber proverb, me and my brother against my cousin, me, my brother, and my cousin against the world. But if you thought about at some local level, you know, me and my brother against my cousin suggests this kind of balance. You see that also in many types of societies. So the ethnography of the Igbo, for example, in southern Nigeria, points out that this was not, the Igbo were not a society which was based on age sets or really kinship systems like this Nuer or Somali. It was much more based on villages and geographical entities. But this is Margaret Green's famous ethnography, Igbo Village Affairs. What she points out is that every Igbo village was separated into two halves. So sometimes ethnographers call this moieties. Separated into two balancing halves. So again, it's this kind of balanced opposition that helped preserve the egalitarianism of the society. Okay? If you've read Achebe's books about the Igbo, You know, you'll know that another way that they controlled ambition, you know, different from the TIV, was this titling society. So if you read, you know, Things Fall Apart, you know that Okonkwo spends all his time trying to acquire titles. You know, like the real way to it, it's like English people with, you know, the MBE, the CBE, the knighthood. The English people just like that, right? So we're all, everyone's living for their, you know, their gong, right? So, you know, but so the Igbo channeled these aspirations into this acquisition of titles. So it kind of took it out of politics. And it's also, in the process of it, dissipated a lot of wealth. So you had to buy titles, it was expensive. You dissipated a lot of wealth, okay? So that's also a way of preserving egalitarianism. If you think about Sierra Leone, or you thought about, you know, the Mende, or, you know, many other people in Sierra Leone, you know, how did they preserve aspects of egalitarianism? Well, secret societies. You know, any village, this is from Little's ethnography of the Mende, you know, every village, I don't know every village. It's hard to collect data. But here's the Poro Bush. Here's the Bundu Sande Society, which is the female secret society. Okay, but there's the male secret society bush, there's the female secret society bush. So secret societies were also a way of constraining power, constraining chiefs, constraining authority. Okay, now again, you might say, okay, is that relevant today? Yeah, sure it is. I don't know what the data is. I'd love to collect data on that. But the secret societies are very prevalent in rural Sierra Leone today. And not just that, but the secret societies have actually present a way of scaling up authority. So one thing I mentioned when I talked about this political systems based on connections and wealth in people, I mentioned they're very hard to scale up, you know. And to me, that's, I'm going to come back and emphasize that later, that one of the huge political problems in post-independence Africa is that Africans had lots of mechanisms at a local level for controlling power. But it was very hard to control the people in Freetown with these mechanisms, or Abuja, or whatever, because it was just hard to scale them up to control. But in Sierra Leone, interestingly enough, they did come up with a mechanism, which is the Freemasons. Okay, so, and this is very prevalent everywhere. You know, who's head of the Freemasons? President Sassou Nguesso of Congo Brazzaville. You know, the Bongos in Gabon. Siaka Stevens, the former head of the one-party state in Sierra Leone, big into the Freemasons. This is the Wusum Masonic Temple. It's being built, the new version of it. It goes back to the 19th century, but the new version of this is being built outside Makeni by former President Karoma, you know, big into the Freemasons. So what the heck is the Freemasons? Well, there's an elective affinity between the Freemasons. It's a secret society. And there's lots of secret societies in Sierra Leone. So here's a modern version of an old institution. It's hard to know how it functions, as I say. Okay. So here's something else Africans have done, which comes up all the time in the literature. So there's this problem. You know, there's this problem. How do we create hierarchy and control it? You know, you've read the Federalist Papers. That's what James Madison was worried about. You know, James Madison had the state-building project. He was worried about how can you create a more effective centralized state and control it. Okay, so here's one thing that's very common in African history, which I'm going to call stranger kings. If you read the history of many African societies, when they centralized, the rulers often came from outside, okay? They were strangers. So this is true in the Kuba Kingdom that Nathan and I did this research on in Kasai in the DRC. The most famous, for me, the most interesting study of this is the Alur. So here's the Alurs up in northwest Uganda. Here's the current king of the Alur. He's got a cool hat. The Alur was studied in the 1970s by Aidan Southall. And Southall pointed out that
The Alur had this king, but the Alur was surrounded by these stateless societies, and there was feuding and a lack of order and conflict. So what did they do? They said, come and rule us, you know, come. And the Alur came, and they made them kings. What did the Alur do? Well, they were outsiders. They were kind of, they were not in the mess. So they were like objective third parties in conflict resolution. Okay, that was a very valuable service. And they were rainmakers. Okay, so they made rain. And that was a very useful service too. And I'm going to, you know, but that's what they did. And one thing, and this is very common in African history, they didn't have any claim on land. This is one way in which Rwanda, for example, is very anomalous, that the king of Rwanda managed to establish property rights on land. But that's not true in most of these examples. So they were very limited. You know, they could make rain, they could solve disputes, they didn't have land. That's what they did. Okay? So this was a way of solving this problem. It was a way of getting some public goods and solving this problem of how to create authority and control it. Okay? So I think this is a very interesting model. What's interesting about this is that, you know, the present king, who's called Olaka Philip Rauni, I don't know, the third, he's now facing a rebellion by the constituent kingdoms, because I guess nowadays maybe the Ugandan state provides, you know, more stuff. I don't know up there, northwest Uganda, maybe there. I'm not sure President Museveni provides more stuff up there in the northwest. But anyway, you know, so he's having a hard time keeping these people are all trying to declare independence nowadays in the Alur kingdom. But I find this a very, very interesting story. It's very common in African history. Okay? So now let me do like something really outrageous and say, okay, so let me take the model of the Alur and reinterpret President Mobutu. Okay? What did President Mobutu did? What did President Mobutu do? More or less what the Alur king did. You know, he didn't provide rain, but he certainly did a lot of supernatural stuff. Okay? He was married to these two sisters. You know, he claimed to be a witch doctor, and he was all into supernatural stuff. Okay? He provided very soothe services like the Alur kings, but he did resolve disputes. Okay? So maybe this is a sort of very James Scott view of the state in Africa, but my sense is that many African states are sort of like this, you know, that the state lacks infrastructural power, but people don't think they can control the state. So that's not such a bad outcome, you know, it seems to me, for many people. They don't get many services. You know, maybe they get some dispute resolution or whatever. And maybe they get some supernatural services. Of course, Mobutu extracted rents. But that's because of this problem that I identified, which is this is not the sort of small-scale societies asking the Alur kings in, or King Shyam becoming the king of the Kuba. How did King Shyam become the king of the Kuba in the 1620s in Congo? Well, they had a competition. You know, they had a competition, and they went to the sacred lake Yule, and the candidates to become the king of the Kuba had to throw these hammers into the lake. And whoever hammers floated, I don't know how they knew that one was going to float, whoever hammers floated would become the king of the Kuba. Okay? So what King Shyam did was he cheated. He got some balsa wood, and then he covered it in like very thin copper. And everybody else had iron hammers. And King Shyam cheated and he became king of the Kuba. So you know, he was clever. And you know, but it was a sort of, he didn't do it by military force or whatever. There was a contest and they were looking for the best person. And it's not, I don't know why, what's significant about the hammer floating, but anyway. So that's, you know, like, in European history, we tend to think of war-made states and states-made war and, you know, people have armies and they invade and they whatever. But I think this model of political centralization is very strong. So, you know,
Here's something from Turner and Young's book, The Rise and Fall of the Zairean State. They're kind of making fun of Mobutu, right? They're making fun of him. Why are they making fun of him? Well, he had this praise song written for him. You can see. Today we're going to admire guide Mobutu. He was the guide, like Gaddafi. If you see him, admire him. If anyone sees him, let him admire him. The country is called Zaire. Kinshasa is a creation of Sese Seko, blah, blah. Okay? So they make this out to be this very odd megalomaniacal thing. But it isn't an odd maniacal thing. It's a very common way of articulating power and expressing power in Africa. You know, Isaac Shapira, the South African anthropologist, transcribed the praise poems of the Swana chiefs. Probably it's a rather obscure book, but it's a rather fine book. This is about Shekedi. Shekedi was the uncle of Seretse Khama, the first prime minister of independence, you know, and he's describing how the lion roared at Shekedi in the veldt. It roared at him with his junior. They were shooting all day, you know, all the young men run away, but not Shekedi, who's not afraid of the lion, you know. So I think this is a very, there's nothing something weird. It's a very traditional way of expressing authority and power in African society. So, you know, Mobutu was tapping into all sorts of traditional ways of exercising power, you know. And everyone likes a good praise singer. You know, this is, I was in Kinshasa last year for Prime Minister Matata's PhD dissertation. I was on his PhD dissertation committee, and here's his praise singers. You know, here's his praise singers. It's a pretty big scale, and, you know, it's pretty much like Mobutu. You know, he's not the president. President Kabila would have a way more serious outfit than this guy with his megaphone. You know, but it's fairly similar. It's like, Matata, he's the greatest prime minister this country's ever had. And, you know, so it's not something weird. It's very traditional. It's a way of tapping into traditional way of thinking about authority and power. And I give you this as an example to say there's a lot of continuity in the way people think about authority in Africa, it always seems to me. Here's another crazy example. You may think this example is even might more crazy than my example of the Minister of Trade in Congo. President Biya, you've read the newspapers, you know that President Biya of the Cameroon, he's been in power a long time, okay? He's also not often in the Cameroon, you know? Between 2006 and 2009, he spent about a third of the year overseas, mostly in the Intercontinental Hotel in Geneva, which I've never stayed in, but I assume it's a fine place. Here he is, you know, he's in Malabo, he's in, you know, Equatorial Guinea, he's in Europe, you know, he comes back, he's in Turkey, whatever. In March 2000, ooh, what did I do? In March 2018, according to the BBC, here we go, he held his first cabinet meeting for 2 years. What the heck is that? You know, like, he's the president of Cameroon. He's been there for decades. Everyone thinks he's this kleptocratic, you know, exploitative, anti-democratic. How do I think about that? Well, I'm not saying that the Cameroonians don't want democracy. I'm sure they do. But I'm saying that this is not an unfamiliar model of authority in African history. The kind of the part-time president or the president divorced from many activities that we'd think of.
Can we move it here?
Okay, are we switching computer?
Yeah, I don't know what happened.
I think I'm too tired to improvise. I could tell jokes. But I'm not very good at that.
Can we ask a question?
Yeah?
Can we ask a good question?
Question is a good idea, yeah.
Do you want water? There's a water.
No, I've got some tea here.
Let me switch computer.
Okay, what's wrong with that one?
The computer is working.
But do we need my flash drive again?
I can take it.
I can bring my flash drive. Finding that's always a problem. and this is possible.
I think that's Rainmaker. That was kind of rain. It's your Rainmaker gesture. On
that's right.
I don't know what kind of. Can I give you the laptop?
We're giving up on that, are we?
Yeah. The panel. Huh? The panel. Complete the power completely off from the panel.
We're giving up on that. Oh gosh, that's very suboptimal. Do you have this problem often?
Can you give an example? Might be.
You have a lot of technology here.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to do. I couldn't do it from the panel.
Okay. All right.
Sorry.
Okay. That's all right. I'm used to functioning without running water and electricity. But I don't usually pretend to give seminars, though. Okay. Once I gave a talk in Bogota, in Colombia, where, you know, where suddenly the thing died, you know, the whole thing died, and I had to go onto the blackboard and start explaining it. And then I noticed that something was really wrong. There was, and in the next room they had this salsa thing, and that was fine. The electricity for playing the salsa was just fine, and it was blasting away. But you know, for me it was out. Okay, so I can have a go. I'll just take a deep breath, so how on earth do I think about Paul Beer? Is he not interested in running the Cameroon? You know, well, it's kind of one way to think about it. So you know, again, if you read the story in the BBC, it's just like, oh, something mad going on in Africa. You know, just like the story about Prime Minister Matata appointing this guy who didn't exist. But, you know, I think there's a logic to it. You know, there's a logic to this way of running things. And maybe it's a sort of James Scott type of logic. But, you know, leaving James Scott aside, it resonates a lot with this. Many, many examples in African history, like the Alur. Okay, what about the economy? Let me talk a little bit about the TIV economy, and I'm going to talk about a very contemporary example of this in Lesotho once I've finished. How did the TIV organize the economy? I think what's interesting about, you know, Africa historically is, along with this wealth in people model and this egalitarianism, there were no factor markets. You know, there was no land market. There was no labor market. How did you mobilize labor to work on land? You used your people, you know. So one of the incentives for accumulating people was to work on your land, work on your farm. There was no market, okay? There is a labor market. A labor market appeared during the colonial period in Africa, and there is a labor market in Africa today. But as I said earlier, land is mostly uncommodified. Okay, so the first thing to understand about the TIV, you know, and this is true of, you know, most parts of rural Africa that I know today, land was not commoditized. They also had this notion of separate spheres, okay, meaning you could make some sorts of transactions, but not other transactions. So in some things, there was a very vibrant market, and there was price flexibility and trade and all this sort of stuff. But other things could not be
bought with money at all. So Bohannon calls these, he calls the things that economists think of as buying and selling commodities. And the other thing he calls prestige goods. Okay, so for commodities, you know, there was trade, there was a unit of account, there was cowries in the pre-colonial period, and then when the British came, there was money. But for prestige goods, you couldn't buy prestige goods. But prestige goods were. What were prestige goods? Horses. In the pre-colonial period, slaves. Different sorts of cloth. Different sorts of gold bar, metal bar, copper bars. So you couldn't buy them with money. You couldn't buy them with cowrie shells. How did you get them? Well, what Bohannon does, he calls it converting. Okay, you could convert. How did you convert? Well, somebody needed to somebody needed to get rid of their prestige goods. Maybe they had a crisis. Somebody was ill. They had a problem. But there was always a problem about acquiring prestige goods. Someone who acquired too many prestige goods could be someone with salve. Same thing. So this was suspicious. Accumulation was suspicious. Accumulation was hard, and when it happened, it was suspicious. Okay? Now, you might think, again, that's a very historical example. Let me give you an extremely contemporary example, which is James Ferguson's ethnography of... Now what's happening?
No power on this.
Oh, I see. Totally, okay.
Yes.
But it's nice aesthetically, isn't it? let me give you a very contemporary example. So you know, Bohannon called this, there are these separate spheres. You know, there's just some things you can't trade for something else. Okay? So let me give you a very contemporary example from James Ferguson's ethnography of Lesotho, which is called the Anti-Politics Machine. So Ferguson, you know, the main point, you know, maybe in his mind, was to make fun of the World Bank. But I don't think that's the interesting thing. But let me tell you why he was making fun of the World Bank. He was working in Highland Lesotho, okay? So there's open range. Too many cows. Erosion, overgrazing. Tragedy of the commons. Okay, the World Bank comes and says, oh, there's a tragedy of the commons. We've got to get rid of those cows. We'll buy the cows off people and get rid of the cows. Or we'll close the range. Nothing happens. Okay, no one takes the blindest bit of difference. The World Bank buys a cow, you just buy another cow. Okay, so what Ferguson shows is that they don't understand the social logic of accumulation at all. All the men in Lesotho are off working in the Johannesburg, in the Rand, in the mines. They make money. They're going to retire back in Lesotho. First of all, you know, it's apartheid, so you can't stay in Johannesburg. The wives are in Lesotho. They want to accumulate for their retirement. How do you accumulate? Well, you could accumulate with money, but that's no good because your wife can spend money. The wife can, but cows, you can't sell a cow. So if you buy a cow and you keep a cow in Lesotho, that has several big advantages. Your wife can't spend it. Nothing, you know, like, sounds a bit sexist, but I'm just describing his research. So that's this separate sphere thing. If you give the wife money, they can spend it. If you give them a cow to look after, they can't sell the cow. So it sort of preserves your... Okay. There's two other really important things about cows. One is, you know, if you're not married, you need cows for bride wealth. Okay? So any respectable, you know, person will give cows for bride wealth. So you need to accumulate cows for bride wealth. The third thing is wealth in people. Okay? You're in Joburg. What do you do with your cows in Lesotho? You give them to people. Okay, you give them to establish social relations. I give you my cow, and then when I come back, you're my person. I have, you know, we have a relationship. You know, you're in Joburg. You can't accumulate relationships in Lesotho. It's difficult. But if you have cows, you can sort of do it. So what Ferguson points out is that, you know, if you want to understand like why the World Bank policies are totally irrelevant, you have to understand the underlying social logic of accumulation and asset acquisition, and then once you see it, you know. But that's a very contemporary example. It's not some archaic ethnographically, it is ethnographically observed, but it's not some colonial, pre-colonial, it's a very contemporary context in Southern Africa, and interestingly enough, a very modernized context, you could say. You know, South Africa, the mines,
Joburg. And in fact, one of the things that Ferguson does is kind of poke fun at the World Bank for sort of saying, oh, Lesotho, it's this little backward, underdeveloped. No, it's not. It's embedded in this massive globalized world and labor markets. And okay, so there's a very contemporary example, which is very related to this discussion of the TIV economy I'm talking about. Here's another example from Soweto, talking about a very contemporary example, which is from Adam Ashford, who's a, I always forget his name, Adam Ashford, no, that's correct. Adam Ashford's book, Witchcraft, Violence and Democracy in South Africa. So what Adam did, he's an anthropologist at the University of Michigan, is it's an ethnography of witchcraft accusations in Soweto. So there's a sort of bigger theme here, which is when witchcraft is such an incredibly prevalent issue in people's lives and kind of source of, I don't know what the right word is, like threat to their welfare, what can liberal democracy do for people's lives when liberal democracy denies that there is such a thing as witchcraft? So there's no such thing as witchcraft in South Africa, according to the law or whatever. But when you go talk to people in Soweto, everybody talks about it. Okay? So what he shows is that, it's a very rich ethnography, which I can't do justice to, just like James Ferguson's book. But he shows that everybody is concerned about witchcraft. Just like the TIV, when somebody gets ill or dies, everyone is thinking this could be caused by witchcraft. Okay, so what do you do? You get a diviner. There's thousands of diviners in Soweto, and you get them to come and say, "Oh, this person, my brother is ill. What do you know?" And then the diviner comes and tries to figure out what the problem is, and then suggests remedies to fight against this witchcraft. Why is there all this witchcraft? Well, his story is really related to a kind of, people have this very zero-sum model of the way the world works. That if you get ahead, it's probably at somebody else's expense. And that creates what he calls jealousy, and it stimulates witchcraft accusations to kind of put people back in their place. So it's a bit, he doesn't describe it in the same way that Bohannon does. But it's this idea of stabilizing some, status quo. And it's very egalitarian. Anyone can do it, okay? So anyone can go to somebody to figure out, how to use witchcraft. It's very egalitarian. And so there's a, that's a very contemporary ethnography. It's related to this TIV discussion I had. So I don't think it's some archaic thing. And I also think, despite the fact there's a lot of social change in Africa, the evidence suggests that, for example, this labour market, there's a lot of super interesting historical books about during the colonial period when suddenly there was this labour market, people could get jobs, they could go to the city, they could kind of get out of these traditional mechanisms of control, they could kind of opt out of this kinship system. That created all sorts of challenges to the hierarchy. But I think, there's many tools that people have used to sort of reassert those relationships and kind of stabilize those relationships. So, for example, in rural Sierra Leone, yeah, it's true, young men are much harder to control than they used to be. They can go to Freetown, they can get a job, they can become an Okada, riding a motorcycle taxi or something. But there's all sorts of instruments for controlling people. So, you still have polygamy. So young men can't get access to women. So the most common legal kind of dispute in rural Sierra Leone is what they call women palaver. Okay? Women palaver is basically a young man has sex, with a wife of a chief or some elder or something. And then the chief, gets them in the court and gets them control and they work on the land. Okay? So I think there's a lot of innovation in these mechanisms over time. Okay. So this, I think, I just want to emphasize this. I mean, I could talk about other examples, but I think the reason I like Ferguson's study of Lesotho and Adam Ashford's study of Soweto is that it's very contemporary about African life and about it. But to me, it resonates a lot with these more historically observed mechanisms. Okay. So what are some... So wealth and people, this egalitarianism and all these mechanisms, I think that explains lots of things about African history. It explains, to me, if you look at Africa, why is it, you see these far, far smaller incidents of these large bureaucratized states historically. So one view would be a geographical view, okay? But I've never liked that view. It sort of pervades African studies. And I guess one of the agendas that I have would be to... Africa's just in a different equilibrium. It's a different equilibrium. And it's an equilibrium which doesn't lead itself to large centralized states for the reasons that I've been discussing. Both this wealth in people, it's hard to scale up. This egalitarianism, you're trying to whittle down authority. It's very difficult to construct states. Even when you do, like the Alor, it's a kind of compromise. You find a way around some of these problems, but in a way that limits the type of state you can have. And I think this has all sorts of historical implications as well for thinking about African development. Think about the slave trade, So you're in a society where wealth is people and you're controlling people. Suddenly there's a big demand on the coast for slaves. People are paying money and guns and all this sort of stuff. It's very easy to supply your dependence to slavers. Like, some sense, you're already in a society where there's immense kind of control over people and you're focused on the control over people. So it seems to me that it's a society which very easily fits into the supply side of the slave trade. And think about colonial rule. Think about the Alor. Southall, in his ethnography, actually kind of raises this issue in the last chapter, which is like, was British rule just like the Alor coming to rule these people? In some sense, people were always used to having these outsiders rule them. And then the British showed up. Not to say that Africans didn't rebel when they realized what a bad deal this was going to be, and that the British were much more intrusive and than the Alor or King Siam had been. But it's an interesting way of thinking about why was it so easy to colonize Africa. Just throwing that idea out there. Okay. And think about... Gosh, this is really cramping my style. I'm sorry. Oh, and I need to show this. And think about, I was going to show the contemporary world. You may have read this Africa Progress report on extractive industries from a few years ago. I have a slide here, which you can't see. So I don't know what the date is. But what's amazing about that Africa Progress report is if you read, you read the appendices, they go through the details of these contracts, these mineral contracts in the DRC. And it's really amazing, the story there. So Gécamines, the Congolese mining company, sells some, the Kolwezi project, they sell the right to mine some coltan deposit or copper, I don't remember what it was now, for $63 million. Okay? So Kunal Mining Limited, who's a kind of completely fake entity, like the British government nowadays, they buy ships off companies that don't actually have ships. So same idea, you pay me $63 million for this coltan. Actually, it's worth $600 million, not $63 million. And 1 month later, you sell it to some legitimate mining company for $600 million. Okay? So the Congolese state receives $63 million for something that's really worth $600 million. They go through a list of these contracts, which are interesting because they can identify all these companies registered in Panama and things like that. Okay? So there, it's not even, I don't know, you can't chase the money, but you have to believe that the Congolese are not even really benefiting from this. It's the mining companies that are ripping
everybody off, including the kind of corrupt people in Jekamine. But I feel it's just like, it's this very personalized way of doing everything that just allows that to happen. You know, so the Africans carry on getting exploited because of this, you know, so because of this way of organizing society. Okay, so I guess, you know, here the argument is that if I thought about this historically, this was perfectly logical. It just turned out this was a perfectly logical way to organize society, but it turned out to be extremely disadvantageous when the slave trade took off, or colonialism, or so Africa got massively exploited by these external forces. Okay, what about exceptions to the rule? Okay, so I gave some examples from Sierra Leone or Nigeria, wherever it was, but you know, there's a lot of variation, you know. So how would I think about, you know, how would I think about Rwanda? Well, I think Rwanda is a massive exception to this story. You know, there is a stranger king. We don't know if he was invited in. You know, Ndori, he comes from the north. It's not clear whether he was invited in or he invaded. I think, you know, Vansina's interpretation is more like he invaded, you know, and that's much less the common story. So that's already kind of a bit anomalous. And then there's this military revolution, you know, these hereditary military regiments appear. The king grabs all the land, again, very anomalous, and it becomes in the 19th century much more like some sort of feudal state, you know. So I guess my point is that, you know, that's not very representative of what you see in Africa. You know, somehow it's, I mean, I, you know, like, how do I think about that? I don't know. Innovation, institutional innovation, you know, like this whole militarization of Rwandan society, which is still extremely prevalent. Any of you who know, have been to Rwanda will know how prevalent it is. You know, that's, it's innovation, you know. So, but I, you know, I think that's just to say, you know, I'm kind of describing this theory, but, you know, every part of the world is a little bit like that, right? You know, so I think Africa is just a bit more like that, but you could sort of say, well, so it's not so surprising that Rwandan path could emerge. And so, you know, that's the way I think about Rwanda, that, you know, it's different because of that, you know, because of that military revolution, and because you get this much more consolidated, you know, central, not bureaucratized, you know, run by the army, but you know, different in the sense that this control of land and cows also, you know, again, you have this cows, you know, the clientelism through cows. You know, Vansina says of the history of the state in Rwanda that the state was created as much by the cow as the spear, you know, by which he means Ndori came with all these cows and he used that to kind of control people. But what's interesting, you know, I think with the Botswana, so that my view is, okay, you know, Rwanda is way off the regression line here. So, for relatively idiosyncratic reasons, I would think. What about Botswana? I think Botswana, the interesting thing about Botswana is that they managed to do what I said is very difficult to do, which is scale up kind of much smaller local level institutions to a national level. You know, they managed to kind of take these local institutions of accountability, this Kahotla, and get it to work at a much larger scale. Maybe because, you know, Botswana is all made up of these Swana people, so there's just much more consensus about how to do things and what are the legitimate set of institutions, and you could, you know, maybe that's part of the story. But I think they managed to solve this problem, you know, that seems to be so difficult to solve. But there's also, you know, more to it than that, in the sense I always think of this example, especially when you compare Rwanda. You know, in the 19th century, while Rwanda was kind of intensifying this servile relationship kind of based on cattle clientelism, so that, you know, so the king gave you a cow and then, you know, you were kind of indebted to the king. But then in the 19th century, they made that relationship hereditary. So now, you know, it used to be that if you gave me the cow back, you were free. But then he made it hereditary, so you couldn't get out of it. And in fact, your children also became my clients. What did they do in Botswana? What did King Kama the Great do?
Well, he said he had the same system of cows. He had his cows. He gave his cows out. He had dependents. What did he do? He said, you know what? Just keep the cows. Forget that. Forget the cows are yours. Then forget it. And then he appointed these governors in the Nguato territory. Okay. So I don't know how you think about that. Is that like leadership? I mean, he gave up all his supernatural powers, unlike President Mobutu. You know, he abolished all of these like rainmaking ceremonies and stuff like that, and he said, we're not celebrating that anymore. That's not what, you know, we'll forget all of that. And then he got rid of this cattle clientelism. I don't know how you think about that. Is that leadership? I don't know. Like, we don't understand things like that as social scientists. So I think you can think of some structural features in Botswana about maybe why it was easier to sort of scale up these local institutions. But things like that, which probably were very important also, are more difficult for me to think about. Okay, I feel like I should shut up now. Let me conclude. How long have I been talking for? Oh yes. Okay, I did better than yesterday. Mm-hmm. But there was an interruption. Okay, so this is a pretty wild talk, and it's a wild talk, and it's very kind of inductive. I've just, you know, for the last few years, or many years, I've been trying to understand African development, and you know, and I think that African society is kind of organized in a different way from Western society. How do you think about that logic? So here, you know, here's two principles of thinking about that logic. You know, this wealth in people and this egalitarianism. I think that, yeah, that's historical, but I tried to suggest I could give more examples that I think that also pervades modern African society. I gave, I gave this example yesterday, but I'll give it again because I like it so much, which is, my wife is from Colombia. You know, we were at this wedding in Cali, and some woman who she has no idea who it is comes up to her and says, what school did you go to? You know, like, what school did you go to? Because if you didn't go to the right school, I why would I bother talking to you? You know, you're just not important. You know, because every important person in Colombia goes to like one of four or five schools. And if you didn't go to one of those four or five schools, you're just like nobody. You know, but I don't think that's what would happen in an African wedding. You know, like, people would come up to you and they'd be so much more inclusive. And, you know, nobody would ask. They'd want to be your friend. They'd want you to be in their social network. They'd want to be friends with you. They'd want to be brother. You'd want to be brother or sister. It's just, you know, that's just a much more inclusive society. So I think, you know, this is, you know, that I find really interesting, because to me, African society is much more kind of achievement-oriented than Latin America. Latin America is so rigid and hierarchical, and to me, there's much more fluidity in African society than there is in... I mean, that's the part of the world I know the best, which to me is a very optimistic thing, because it means that, you know, if you could just get some things working, there's all this potential for social mobility, and you don't have this kind of stifling classism and hierarchy that you have in Colombia or Peru or any of these countries in South America. So I don't think this is, you know, this is partially a kind of academic enterprise, trying to sort of think about these principles and how they influence kind of development in Africa. But I also want to say that, you know, I think it actually has some interesting implications for thinking about, you know, the future in Africa. For me, as I said earlier, you know, the biggest problem in Africa since independence is just this inability to scale up, you know, these controls over power to control the people in Freetown or whatever it is. And yeah, there's this Allure type model, and you know, the Mobutu thing was just a little bit provocative, you know, but of course they didn't, it wasn't built up from the bottom up the way that Allure was, right? So, you know, it was plonked down on top by the colonial powers, and that's a very different problem to control or solve. And let me just finish by saying, you know, how is Africa, from this perspective, how is Africa different? Well, I guess I'd like to develop the idea that Africa is not different from the rest of the world, you know, because of geography or latitude or the tsetse fly or malaria, not the malaria or whatever doesn't have enormous, you know, welfare consequences for people. But, you know, I think it's much more a case of just getting into a different social and institutional equilibrium. It's not about fundamentals determining African poverty. It's just that African society organized in a particular way, I think, for kind of clear, logical reasons, but it's just very difficult to scale up. It led to this enormous history of exploitation, as I just sketched. And it's still difficult to construct, you know, effective, legitimate states and scale up these controls. So I'll shut up and you can ask questions. Yeah. Sorry about this. Did I have that?
So James, sorry for the sudden technological shock. I'm glad you're not taking us through a formal mathematical model. That would have been far worse to if you had to take us through equations.
That's
it's
coming.
A very rich interpretation of Africa.
Sorry.
I had a quick question, but I'm going to keep it at the end. But let me just take three questions. Is that okay, three questions, or you want to go one by one?
If I had something to write them down.
Okay, let's give you a piece of paper.
If I could write them down, yeah. Like we could do three. That's probably more efficient.
That'll be probably more efficient.
And it's also good because I'll be able to ignore the things that I won't be able to answer.
Okay, so three questions. Who wants to do the first three? Okay, Rachel. Marcel. And sorry, your third, right there. Okay, Rachel, you can go first.
So, this was great. Thank you. I guess I'm wondering about these two principles and how they fit together, because in some ways they seem a bit contradictory, right? So the wealthy people seems to imply that the patron is not equal to the others.
This
radical egalitarianism. So I'm wondering how they fit together. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
I think you're right, but I think it's a very limited sort of hierarchy is created by it. Yeah, it's true that there is hierarchy within these patron-client networks or within social networks or whatever, but it's kind of big men type, you know. You can't really scale it up to be very powerful. You can't really pass it on to your children. You know, I mean, maybe it's more easier to pass it on to your children in the modern world because you have all these institutions. You know, like President Kabila could make his son, well, you know, at least his people could make his son president. So. But I think that, you know, so I think that is, I guess my first point is it's sort of intrinsically limited, you know, and it interacts with these other things in a way that makes it even more limited. You know, the fact that there's no commodification of land means, you know, you can't accumulate land. You know, if you're a big man, you know, you can't really accumulate, you can pass that on to your children, but you can't, if it's not commodified, you can't accumulate land. So I think a lot of the economic institutions kind of made sure that there were limits to, yeah, there's some type of hierarchy was not institutionalized, was advantageous, but it was hemmed in with other features of what I was sort of describing. And there were all these other mechanisms that stopped it getting too out of control, you know, like the witchcraft, like this balanced opposition that you see, you know, again, sometimes there's more, you know, more institutionalized, like the Samburu or these places in East Africa which adopted these kind of age set systems. So you're right, I understand what you're saying, but I think there is a way in which they kind of reinforce themselves. Like I think about the economy as sort of stabilizing. Yeah, there's a little bit of hierarchy, but it limits what can happen.
Marcel?
To continue on this, because you were saying Africa was in a kind of equilibrium, So can you elaborate a little bit on what type of equilibrium are you talking about, and which forces do we see to keep an equilibrium, and do we need a big push to get out of this, and what kind of big push are you thinking of?
Well, I don't know about a big push. I mean, you know, I think these sort of principles explain how lots of institutions work in Africa. So, you know, I think what I like so much about Ferguson's book is that, you know, he shows how these principles explain why the World Bank policy in Lesotho was so completely ineffectual. So that's, maybe it's too specific a case. But I would say, you know, if we understood these principles better, then we'd be able to figure out how could you maybe build on them in order to get institutions to work better. You know, just
just ignoring them seems to be a very odd idea to me. I mean, for example, I was at a talk at the same conference in London Business School, and somebody was evaluating a project by BRAC. Okay, BRAC, you know, this Bangladeshi NGO. So BRAC had this big women's empowerment project in Sierra Leone, okay? Women's empowerment. And the idea was you create a safe space for women in every village. But there's already a safe space for women in a Sierra Leone village. It's called the Female Secret Society Bush. But they didn't know that. You know, like, they'd never heard of that. So I just, like, I sat there thinking, what, you know, what planet am I on here? You know, like, so I'm just, this is a sort of plea for thinking much more about, you know, the soap I was calling, maybe inappropriately, I like that phrase, but perhaps, like, you know, the social logic of accumulation or something. Like, so I think that's, I don't know about the big push. I mean, that's a, I don't know if a big push would change this in the sense of a traditional kind of Rosenstein, Roland, Murphy, Vishnu, Schleifer kind of big push. I guess I think more like, you know, if you're in the business of institution building and building states and building accountability, then you have to think, you know, you have to think about how this works, how the society works. That would be my, I don't know how I think about the big push. I haven't thought about that, to be honest, honestly.
Yes, question in the back.
My question is concerns your work in Bolivia. So would you rather take a question on the theme of today, as there are only three questions?
Oh, yes, I completely ignored that rule. Okay, well, now we're just answering them. Sorry.
Yeah, I have a question on Bolivia, that's what. I'm
Bolivia?
Yeah.
Go for it.
Thank you.
Go for it.
I'm very much waiting for your results of your research in Bolivia.
Oh, yeah, we're doing this work with Pablo Celaya on the rise of the mass. Yes.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I ask you because I'm working, I'm doing research on pop music roots of young women in Cochabamba. Quechua speaker,
yes.
Speaking young woman from Cochabamba.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yes.
And I can immediately relate many things, like this compulsory egalitarianism. Someone becomes very popular.
Yeah.
She's immediately accused of witchcraft, and if you have something, you have to somehow combat it.
Share.
But then there is this very hierarchical system. But I think only Evo Morales himself is safe from accusations of witchcraft until now.
I see. Yeah.
But I don't know.
Yeah, I don't. I. Yeah, I mean, I. You know, what we're doing is just looking at. We're looking at the impact of coca eradication on the rise of the mass and showing that the rise of the mass is very associated with coca eradication. That they the vote share grows much faster in places where there's coca eradication. But what's really interesting, which I don't understand anything about, you can tell me, is this IUS. That what we got this data in La Paz. Pablo got this data about the incidence of these Ayus. So this is this like traditional kind of indigenous council or local organization. And the effect is much larger in places which have an Ayus according to this data. So somehow the traditional council or like in local institutions, I have to admit I do not understand them. I don't understand how they operate, and I don't understand the variation either. Like, why is it in some places and not others? We're going to do some field work in the summer. We find that the effect is much bigger in places with ayahs. So it seems that where you have these traditional institutions, the mass are able to organize much more successfully. Okay, sorry.
Thanks for all questions. And did you have a question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the absence of, you know, or if there are incorrect labor markets, then do you see institutions historically in Africa, you know, like Bermuda, essentially labor inbound institutions like Bermuda and Peru, just where you require...
Slavery, you have slavery, yeah, I mean,
And
not organized in the same way, no, No,
maybe I think it was kind of being at one extreme.
Yeah.
Sense, you know?
No, I mean, the way Rattray talks about it is that there's a sort of continuum. You know, there's a continuum between you're my, you know, you're my person, you're my friend, to, you know, maybe you're my pawn, you know, or you're my ward. And in the limit, you know, there's you're my slave. But again, you know, this is a very contested thing. Stanley Engelmann, you know, the great economic historian of slavery, always used to say that anyone who studies slavery in a particular society always ends up by concluding that slavery in that society was much less bad than anywhere else. So there's one narrative that in Africa that slavery wasn't really so bad, it was just the limit of this personal kind of dependence, you know, and then it wasn't commodified, you know, until the Europeans showed up. That does seem to be true in the sense that you and I might have had slaves, but we weren't buying and selling them. But when the Europeans came, then we sold them, you know, then we took them to the coast and sold them. So that does seem to be true. But that system of coerced labour like that, I don't know, it might be true in the Sahel, like Ghana and Mali. I'm not sure what the answer is. It could be true in the Sahel. But again, I think that's mostly slavery, you know, because there was this trans-Saharan. So there really was, you know, selling slaves back in the medieval period. But again, I think that's more like that's different from the West African forest or Central Africa, because they're in this, you know, world, this Mediterranean world.
Can I?
You want to follow?
So then I wonder if it goes back to your other argument, which is that in a sense to get an institution like UNITA working, you know, there's no equivalent of the Spanish, you know, colonizer sort of, you know, like this top-down hierarchical kind of imposition that says you must do this, and maybe that's your point, that, you know, which is that you don't have this kind of overarching, you know, this very hierarchical authority that,
yeah,
that kind of, you know...
I think, you know, one, you know, the Rwandan case is an exception to this. You know, in the 19th century, the Rwandan state kind of reduced, you know, most of the rural population to serfdom, you know. But again, that's very unusual. That's very unusual because they had this military and coercive capacity, which was very unusual in pre-colonial Africa.
Okay, more questions? So, Charles, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know if this is a kind of silly point, but if you say it did not scale up, but something was scaled up, so, you know, these scaled up, there are scaled up entities there,
yeah,
which are operating with a system which doesn't scale up.
I mean, yeah.
So that it's something, they're operating in an environment which they can't operate.
But I think, you know, if you think about, leaving aside the colonial period, if you think about pre-colonial Africa and you think about the kind of existing states, you know, apart from, you know, in this Niger Bend or whatever, and apart from places where they kind of imported models from across the Sahara, like, you know, this you know, the Fulani Jihad or whatever, where they had cavalry and they had these, you know, Mediterranean models of state formation, which really diffused through Islam, and, you know, so then there was, you know, then you've got much more hierarchy in Kano or these places in the north of Nigeria, you know, but and, you know, other places in that Sahel fringe. But most of these states, you know, that are very small scale, you know, like even the Shanti or the Kuba state, or, you know, you see, you don't see a lot of centralized authority. And I think, you know, there are these tricks, like with cows. You know, why is there so much more centralization, you know, in this in these parts of East Africa? Well, you have cows, you know, you don't have tsetse fly. So cows allows you to sort of scale up, you know. And then you have other military revolutions, like Shaka Zulu. You know, what did Shaka Zulu do? You know, he had a military revolution too, you know. He organized the society differently, you know, he changed the combat techniques, and so he managed to create a bigger state, you know, through military intervention. But I think that's, so he kind of overrode all these mechanisms that I'm talking to in the same way that they overrode them in Rwanda. But I think the big picture there is you don't have these large, there's very few successful examples of scaling this up. Sometimes you have cows, and that's useful. but that's a, you know, that helps. But generally, I think the big picture is you don't have a lot of that. I mean, it's true also the slave trade. You could say the slave trade precipitated centralization, you know, Kingdom of the Congo or Oyo in Nigeria or whatever. So there are some examples of the slave trade created these much more militarized, you know, because they got guns from the Europeans. And so that was a sort of, that was something that allowed you to kind of break through these mechanisms. But again, you know, I'd like to say, you know, in my personal experience, you know, a lot of the, I think these mechanisms are real today in Africa. Africa changed a lot, and Africa's very diverse. And but I still think these, you know, these things are there, influencing all sorts of stuff.
So, Jason, I have two questions.
Yeah.
One is, I wasn't sure what is causal here. I mean, can't you argue that economic accumulation, the fact there was all these constraints, economic accumulation, geography, colonial legacy, whatever,
yeah,
led to the fact that the incentive starts to shift to the social accumulation. Social accumulation is an endogenous response to the fact there was an economic accumulation. So I don't really couldn't see what caused what in your argument. So, you know, number three was that where is Ethiopia in the story? Is it off the regression line then? Because Ethiopia is also fairly successful in, you know, a strong state, public goods delivery, some kind of growth. So again, is it in your Rwanda space, or where exactly is Ethiopia?
Yeah, but I, you know, so that's, you know, that's right. I, you know, I don't have a causal model here, you know, or estimates. But I think it's like, why would you want to disincentivize? I understand, you know, like you could take the view of the world, you know, that Africa had some, you know, like there were some very bad fundamentals, so that there was very low return to investment or accumulation or whatever. But I, you know, I find it hard to understand why you would then put all these impediments in the way of accumulation. Wouldn't you still try to stimulate it or encourage it or facilitate transactions or so? But you're right, you know, ultimately that's a kind of empirical question. You know, we did write a paper about that a long time ago. But obviously here, what would be nice would be to do something much kind of tighter and more micro, and I'm still thinking about that. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, at this level, you're right. Yes, yes.
Ethiopia?
Well, you know, I think Ethiopia, you could say that's also, you know, like Rwanda, it's a very anomalous case. You know, I mean, Ethiopia had a centralized state for thousands of years, you know, like they adopt, you know, was it King Ezana adopted Christianity like 5 years after Constantine did or something? And, you know, Ethiopia was kind of, you know, they had writing, they had the plow, you know, they had wheels, all the other stuff that sub-Saharan Africa didn't have. They were kind of, you know, they were locked into this, you know, Eastern Roman Empire, you know. So I would think, you know, I see Ethiopia is also having a very different, I mean, I don't know very much about Ethiopian society, I have to say. So, but I see Ethiopia as also being locked in a very different historical dynamic from the rest of sub-Saharan Africa.
Okay. All right. Any more questions? Oh, Tony, sorry.
One thing we know about Africa is the population growth is very high. And you look at the UN projections of 2050 or even earlier, you know, Nigeria, Tanzania, you know, they're well up there in some of the biggest countries in the world. So I wonder if you have any speculations about what this very large urbanization that will go alongside population growth will mean for the kinds of structures you found.
Well, very high rates of population growth is easy to explain with this way of thinking, right? So.
Sorry, it wasn't much explaining the high population growth. It's more the consequence of the high population growth will be for the structures that you've found and argued for.
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I would think the, you know, the projections for what the population of Kinshasa will be in 2050 are absolutely frightening. You know, people say there's going to be like 50 million people, and you know, it's I don't, there's no public good provision, and there's a very interesting recent Christoph Titeka, who's an anthropologist who works in Congo, who's at Antwerp, has this recent study about the spread of informal settlement in Kinshasa, and it's completely unplanned, disorganized. There's no public goods, there's no sanitation, there's no, you know, the government just doesn't regulate it. And I would think that I haven't really thought about that. I'm not sure I really have the intelligent answer, but I would think it's terribly difficult to manage. But on the other hand, there are places that are doing a lot better. If you think about Lagos, you know, in the last 20 years, Lagos has been a remarkable success story in terms of public good provision and kind of tax revenue and trying to improve institutions. And so you know, how do I think about that? I don't know. Yoruba nationalism. That was a provocative. I was expecting somebody to complain about that. I don't have a good explanation, but the, you know, the Lagos case is very interesting in the sense that there are places that can get their act together, and you know, why is that so difficult in Kinshasa? And you know, it's hard to know. The political system is more democratic, more accountable. You know, the improvements in Lagos come, you know, with the elections of governor, Lagos State, 1999. It's not the whole story, but maybe it's part of the story. They got rid of the military. That wasn't very good for economic development in Nigeria. But that's not the whole story. And in fact, of course, democracy came everywhere in Nigeria, and not everywhere is like Lagos. In fact, I met the Governor Fashola, who was the second governor after Governor Tinubu, who did this in Lagos. And he was telling me, oh yeah, we're trying to spread this model everywhere in Nigeria, but it's not very successful. So I asked him, like, why is that? You know, why isn't it successful? He said, like, stomach infrastructure. I said, what does that mean? He said, like, well, we offer real infrastructure, and our opponents offer stomach infrastructure. It's like, what do you mean by that? Food. Money, food, and you know, people are poor, and you know, someone comes and they offer you food and money, and you vote for stomach infrastructure. So Lagos has a middle class. You know, it has banks, it has businesses, there's a demand for public goods. You know, much more so than in Kinshasa, for example. You know, there's not much of a middle class in Kinshasa compared to Lagos. So maybe that's part of the story, also. You know, I mean, I work a lot in Colombia, and you see in Colombia that the places in Colombia that are successful, like relatively successful, like Bogota and Medellin, they're definitely the places with a middle class where there's really some demand for public goods and security and nice roads and parks. And, you know, in fact, the same thing, you know, when they try to spread that model to other parts of Colombia, it hasn't been so successful at all. But, yeah, that's a very partial. But I bet, you know, I don't really have an answer to your question. I'm just improvising.
Okay. Well, James, it's 5:30, so
okay.
Thanks so much for your
right.
And honor to your, you know, yesterday and today. Two long lectures, actually.
Yeah.
So thank you, and
okay.
Let's give it.